Hello again, and welcome to Musings on Sports, where great storytelling is our passion. I'm Kelly Elbin, along with Bob Bupka. Bob, we have quite a few items to discuss, and then we're going to be welcoming in Dan Quinn, 14-year NHL vet, five-time winner of the American Century Celebrity Golf Classic. Talk about a guy who knows how to have success on the ice and on the golf course, huh?
And he's quite a player, and I had the pleasure of seeing him play a couple of times when I would cover that event out at Lake Tahoe, the Celebrity Classic that he actually won five times.
Yeah, good player. Lives down here in South Florida near me, and I think the listeners will find his story really interesting. Canadian kid growing up, and both hockey and golf were big-time parts of his life as a kid, and obviously carried through to adulthood. A few things to cover. Bob, this whole situation with the Indianapolis Colts firing head coach Frank Reich, replacing him with beloved former center, Colts center Jeff Saturday as the head coach. Jimmy Irsay, the owner of the Colts has struggled in the last couple of years. The team has struggled to find a quarterback of competence. Carson Wentz was let go. They brought in Matt Ryan from the Falcons. That didn't work out. And so he's made the decision to let go of Reich, but in replacing him with Jeff Saturday, the guy's never coached beyond high school. And there's a lot of issues that I've heard and read about. Is this really keeping a qualified black head coach from at least having an interim opportunity? Frankly, I think it's a slap in the face of all assistant head coaches in the NFL, and particularly on his staff, to bring in a guy who's never coached. And on top of it, the guy who's going to be calling the plays for them this Sunday has never called plays in an NFL game. This is the National Football League, Bob.
Yeah, but I look at it through a little bit different lens. As far as I'm concerned, Jeff Saturday has never called the wrong play, has never made the wrong decision on a player being on the team or off the team, and he's got a 50-50 chance. He may make all the right calls or he may make all the wrong calls. But no matter who you hire, that would be the same. It's kind of interesting to me. Maybe that's because I'm such an oddball, but hiring a guy that hasn't had any NFL experience to be a NFL coach, if he does well, I guarantee you, you'll see some more coaches being hired without experience.
Well, that was Jim Irsay's line of logic and rationale. I don't necessarily buy it. I don't know that the Colts are necessarily tanking, but you could certainly make a case for it based on these decisions that the owner has made. And by the way, the Colts are scheduled to be on prime time three more times this season. I would imagine you're going to see them flexed out of some of those games and put some legitimate teams in place that have chances to make the NFL playoffs. Hey, Bob, staying with football, there's been a lot of talk for a long time about Dan Snyder, the owner of the Washington Commanders, and I think you're seeing a fast track right now based on everything that this clown has done for 30 years of pure hell that he's brought to the fan base in Washington. And it's a very personal thing for me because I'm a huge Washington fan of seeing a guy single-handedly destroy an organization. A fast track to get him out, I think there's more of that than him looking to sell the team. I think he's being pressed by the ownership to do it. You're seeing Jeff Bezos' name thrown around, Jay-Z's name thrown around. Matthew McConaughey is even involved. He's a big-time Washington fan. I think you're going to see the sale of this team a lot faster than perhaps some may think. And let me tell you what, if that happens, you will see a parade in Washington, the likes of which you haven't seen in a very long time, because it would remove a very bad guy from an ownership of the National Football League.
Well, you're a little harsh there, partner, but certainly a lot of people agree with you. A new owner coming in, the Washington Commanders fans will definitely be happy about that. Let's move on to golf a little bit.
Yeah.
Mr. Kelly Elbin, passing of Dow Fistewall. Wow. What a player he was.
And what a gentleman he was. I got to know Mr. Finsterwald through my time at the PGA of America when I oversaw the PGA Museum of Golf, and Dow was nice enough to loan some of his personal golf medals and so forth from his time at the University of Ohio, and then from his professional days. Dow is noted first and foremost because he won the 1958 PGA Championship at Lanark Country Club outside of Philadelphia, the first year that the PGA of America made the decision to go from match play in the PGA Championship as its format to stroke play. Television was coming along. A guy named Arnold Palmer was beginning to catch the fancy of the American sports public. And Dow played really well that week, obviously, and won the PGA Championship, the only major that he won. Longtime proponent of the PGA of America and its efforts to grow the game, and just a really terrific guy, lived a good, long, full life, and will be remembered for that place in history. And interestingly enough, he and Arnold lived very close to one another at Bay Hill in Orlando and were the best of friends for many, many years.
Yeah, good friendship there. And Dow was a wonderful person, tremendous talent playing the game, but off the golf course, he was aces in my book. Speaking of aces, how about the Father Time guy, Bernhard Langer, gets his 44th win on the PGA Tour Champions. He's now only one behind. Oh, you know who he is. None other than Hale Irwin.
Well, that Irwin number of 45 wins on the PGA Tour Champions was thought to be untouchable. But you talk about numbers just being exactly that. At age 65, it's just an age for Bernhard Langer. He's kept himself in incredible condition. And I think in addition to physically, mentally as well, Bob, he's extremely sharp. He works at his game all the time. He doesn't let outside influences get to him in any way, shape, or form. And now he'll get that 45th win and probably a 46th win and become the all-time winner on the PGA Tour Champions. He's won a bunch of those events in Boca Raton, not far from where I am and near where he lives. He's an extraordinary golfer, Bob. He's 65 years old and playing like he's 35 years old.
Yeah, I got a kick. Recently, I was doing an interview with him, and I said, you know, Bernhard, it looks like you haven't even gained any weight since you played on the PGA Tour. He said, no, Bob. 2 pounds. I said, really? He says, yeah, but it's all muscle.
Exactly. That's right. And if he could turn that muscle and lose those 2 pounds, but still keep the muscle, he would happily do it. Also in the news, the match, I think it's great. December the 10th, it's going to be a prime time thing. And I like that they're getting back to just professional golfers and not this Tom Brady and Aaron Rodgers stuff. So we got Tiger and Rory against Justin Thomas and Jordan Spieth. 12-hole match at Bel Air Country Club. Excuse me, at Pelican Golf Club in Bel Air, Florida. I think it's terrific. Hey, Bob, since they started this the match in 2018, they've raised $33 million for charity, and you know they're going to raise a lot more for the victims of Hurricane Ian through these 12 holes and these four very, very popular and well-known PGA Tour players.
Yeah, it's going to be kind of interesting because it's going to be under the lights. And
yep.
Speaking of interesting, Kelly, it's certainly going to be interesting when basketball starts. No Coach K at Duke, no Jay Wright at Villanova. Good golly, Miss Molly, what's going on?
Yeah, they have tipped off the college basketball season, and Joe Lunardi, famous for bracketology, will be our guest next week to talk about that. And yeah, it's odd to see no Coach K on the Duke sidelines after an unbelievable career, the greatest college basketball coach ever retiring. And Jay Wright, surprisingly, retiring with still a number of good years left in him at Villanova. Kind of a bit of a turning of the clock that way, but I'm really anxious to hear what Joe's going to have to say next week in terms of who he sees as the teams to watch this year. Duke will still be good. Villanova will still be good. But before we get to that discussion with Joe Lunardi next week, really excited for everybody to hear this week and in just a few minutes from our guest, Dan Quinn, again, 14-year NHL veteran, 5-time winner of the American Century Celebrity Golf Classic. And we're going to hear from Dan Quinn right after this word from our good friends at Bridgestone Golf.
Today, there are smarter phones, smarter cars, smarter everything. So Bridgestone Golf's engineers thought, why not a smarter golf ball? Introducing the new Tour B with a smart reactive IQ cover that delivers more power off your driver, more control off your wedges. Try Bridgestone's new Tour B with reactive IQ cover, the smarter tour ball.
Welcome back to Musings on Sports. Our guest today played 14 seasons in the National Hockey League, appearing in the Stanley Cup Finals. Then he found success in another sport, winning the American Century Celebrity Golf Classic 5 times, while also caddying for the likes of major golf champions John Daly and Ernie Els. It's a pleasure to welcome Dan Quinn to Musings on Sports. Hey, Dan, how are you, man?
Good morning, Kelly. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing great. Really pleased that you could join us. We haven't had a lot of hockey guys on here, so I'm delighted to talk a little hockey and certainly cross over and talk about your successes on the golf course. Hey, I want to start out, you know, you grew up in Brockville, Ontario. I believe that's Eastern Ontario. I would imagine, Dan, hockey was pretty much everything to you as a kid, like so many other Canadian youngsters.
Yeah, no, for sure. To be said, just to clarify, my family moved to Brockville when I was 16. I actually only spent a summer or two. I was born in Ottawa, to answer your question. But we moved to London, Ontario when I was 12, and that's where I fell in love with the game of golf. You know, my grandfather, I think when I was 10, got me some clubs for Christmas. But when I was 12 or, you know, the summer of 77, turning 12, we moved to London, and it was there's a great little executive course, 9 holes that I would say. It's called Thames Valley. I can remember it like yesterday. And you could play $2, play all day. So we played 45, 54 holes. And it had an 18-hole public course. You know, once you got better and good enough, you could go play it. So it was a great way to learn to, you know, play golf at an early age with great access. And in those 4 years I spent in London before I took off to play junior hockey is where I played in Ontario juniors and amateurs and started to play competitively and played, you know, the men's amateurs. And when I was 15 and 14, it was a great way to spend summers. As much as hockey is definitely Canada's sport, I think Canada has the largest per capita of handicap indexes of any country in the world. Like 40% of the country has a handicap.
Well, that's fascinating. So growing up, you were a dual sports guy in a lot of ways, right? Playing throughout the shortened summer months, playing golf, and then obviously hockey. Did you start playing hockey as a tiny kid? Did you know at a certain point that you were going to have the opportunity perhaps to play at a higher level?
Yeah, so you know, I started skating and playing. I started skating at 2 and was in an organized league at 4, playing against 5 and 6 year olds. But so yeah, and I was kind of played ahead. The year of 81, again, I was really into golf. 1980, sorry, and when I was 15 and 16 is when there was a little bit of conflict. Besides playing in the year I was drafted to play junior, I knew again when I was 15 or 16 that I had a chance that, you know, hockey had to become number one on full time and once. So, but yeah, I moved away to play for the Ontario Hockey League as the first overall pick when I was 16. But that same summer of 81, I made a cut, a 72-hole event, Ontario Amateur, which I still was one of my coolest because it was won by a Canadian golf legend named Gary Cowan, who won a couple times the U.S. Amateur a few times and played in the Masters numerous times. So it was fun to be in that. And I remember the, you know, a few of the names were guys that I'd always admired in Canadian golf up until that point.
Yeah, who were some of the guys that you admired, Canadians as far as golf, and who were some of the NHL greats that you admired growing up?
You know, Canada, you know, we had some great players and George Knutson and guys, a little bit before me, we have the legendary Mo Norman, who I'd met and been around, and I caddied in a tournament where he played in front of me at the Ontario Open at a place called St. Thomas Country Club. My dad loved to take me out of school and let me go if I could do that, and it's just when I fell in love with the game of golf. Canadians, we play hockey left-handed, play golf right-handed. There wasn't equipment, you know, in the 80s and 70s for lefties. Mike Weir kind of changed all that. You know, he grinded his way out and made it through Asian tours and mini tours to become a great tour player and President's Cup player, but to win the Masters for a kid from Canada is a dream that none of us ever would have had. So I always say that was one of the greatest moments for any Canadian in any sport. Of course, meeting and being around hockey my whole life and some of the greats and Wayne Gretzky and Mario Lemieux and having met and played golf with Bobby Orr, one of my idols as a kid, has always been a perk to being an NHLer. If you look at Canadian golf now, we've got half dozen, 10 guys on tour that are doing well, from Adam Hadwin and so on and so forth to Mackenzie Hughes, I think just won a second tournament a couple of weeks ago. Yes, so I follow all of them and it's been great. And I think, but Weirsie kind of, he set the tone and a lot of kids from Canada are getting playing D1 golf. There's, it's pretty interesting. I have a 16-year-old son. So I noticed that the head coach of Notre Dame is from Canada. Head coach from Tennessee is from Canada. Head coach of University of Florida is from Canada. So it's been interesting that, how big golf is for our small country of 33-34 million.
Well, and Corey Connors is another one who's played extremely well and has made.
My bad. Yeah, from Southern Ontario, staying from Listowel, Ontario. Corey Connors. I think Weirsie kind of getting out there and winning on tour, and then saying that you can be from Canada and grow up in a cold climate. And obviously, the evolution of all sports, especially in training and whatnot, makes it hitting bays are now very, very productive, where those did not exist when we were kids, or even till probably 10-15 years ago, where you could do work in cold weather. You could train off get your body in the right shape and so on and so forth. So it's definitely changed, where if a kid really wants to put in the time and put the work in and he's got some talent, he can still make it as a Canadian.
Yeah, no question about it. Dan, I have to ask you, not everybody gets to be drafted into a major sports league. The Calgary Flames drafted you with the 13th overall pick in the 83 NHL entry draft. What was that day like for you? What was it like to actually be drafted by the biggest league in the sport that you grew up, that is the national pastime in Canada?
I remember pretty vividly. It was in June of 83. I was 18 years old, and we'd gone up the night before, and it kind of segues into another part of what happened. On the night before, I saw the Pirates play the Expos and the Big O, and Rick Roden, who I ended up battling for a number of years on the celebrity circuit and Lake Tahoe and whatnot, was the pitcher. I remember that. And getting up the next morning, getting drafted, having an idea that I wouldn't go past 14th. I went 13th to Calgary because Washington was picking 14th and had been to see me a few times. So that's sort of where it went. And, it's just everything kind of goes fast. A couple of years, you sit back 40 some years later and wish you knew what you knew then. Know now what you knew then, but versus whatever that saying is, but wish I knew then what I know now. It was a journey. Let's just put it that way.
You, your third season with the Flames, you played a big role in helping them advance to the Stanley Cup final. Obviously, you lost to the Canadiens in that series. What's it like playing for the Stanley Cup, getting to the finals and playing for the Cup?
Well, for me, and I think, it changed. And I wish I would have been, again, looking back, I was 20 and it was you think it was going to happen every year and you take for granted. And I never got back to the finals, but it was an all-Canadian final. But the Battle of Alberta was sort of what I was thrown into in 83, which was against the great Oilers team that won 4 out of 5 years. And when we played them in my first year of 7-game series, and we lost, and they won their first cup in 84. And then we beat them in 86. And to have that happen was, a big nothing. It was sort of like the biggest thing. And we were shocked and surprised and excited. And then we lost to Montreal in the finals. Again, I don't know that we had the same intensity or the same, desire to get that victory that we did against the Oilers as a group. And it just was always the fact that it was a disappointment. But at the end of the day, it was an all-Canadian final the Cathedral of Hockey at the time, the Montreal Forum, was, we played a couple games in there. My family got to come see it. And the thing I look back to saying, as I regret it, is I thought I would do it a couple more times, and I never did.
Yeah, but you made it to that one final. I'm wondering, Dan, from your perspective, I know you keep a close watch on the National Hockey League today. What's it like? What's the game like, the pace of the game, the way it's played today, in your opinion, versus back in the early 80s when you broke in? How is it similar in some ways? How is it? It's got to be very different, though, in a lot of ways, right?
Well, it's a lot different. The equipment changed everything, and the bigger guys didn't have skates that could hold them and support them. They had to be very careful for agility-wise. But the equipment has really changed. The skates are about a quarter of the weight that our soaking wet leather skates used to be. The guys have year-round training and nutrition that is unprecedented that we didn't have. That said, the game we played was a lot more barbaric because there was fighting, and it was pretty much just don't get caught and you could get away with anything. And otherwise it was, you know, wouldn't be a penalty. So it's cleaned up the game today. I wasn't a big fan of the game when it was clutch and grab and it needed to clean up in the late 90s. And then into the 2000s, there was the officiating didn't know how to do it, or they didn't know where they wanted to go with it. But the game of hockey right now is terrific. There's some phenomenal hockey players and athletes. I watched them all interview. They're all so humble and, the NHL has done a great job overall with its the product. And it's, I'll always say that I played in a great era, great teams, some of the best players, Mario Lemieux and Gretzky. But you have to say that the game is really in a good place right now. And you can tell by the fan support and the interest that's ongoing.
You talked early on about your days as a youngster playing the game of golf. You during your hockey days, when you guys would travel, did you have times at all where you would, if you had an off day, would you go and play golf? Or how did you balance golf during the season? And then I would imagine once the season ended, you were pretty much full-time golf during those days.
Yeah, so back in those days, the mentality was if you didn't play, you practiced. So you didn't have days, you were tired, and I played in cold weather climates. So there was the odd occasion where, that said, no, Calgary, I remember 1 year took us down in mid-season after, I think, a game in L.A., and then they got us over at resort so we could go play golf for a day, wait like a four-day break. I remember Philadelphia did the same thing one time. So you're kind of, you're tired and you're in the middle of your season, but, it would be nice to get out and the fresh air would knock you out. But it was, even when I played in L.A., I played a little bit of golf, but not during, it's just hard to do during the season. You're either recovering or you're practicing or you're on the road playing or you got a game that night. But, I'm sure guys in some of these warmer climates now, there's so many cities, they do play on occasion or go hit balls just to something to clear their mind. But that didn't play a whole lot in season to answer your question.
Right. Yeah. We're joined by Dan Quinn, 14-year NHL veteran who went on and won five times at the American Century Celebrity Golf Classic. Hey, Dan, well, I believe one of those years that you won, you were still an active player. Celebrity circuit in golf was starting to form and gaining some popularity. Did you feel like you had the ability early on, even during your days of playing, of competing? Obviously, you did. You played well and you won. Did you always feel like you could compete at that level?
Well, yeah, I played tournament golf as a kid, as I mentioned, and, from Ontario Amateurs and whatnot. And then in the summers when I got to Pittsburgh, I didn't play too much competitive golf. I played a tournament back in Brockville called the Wiley, and I'd play a little bit. And then didn't play a lot of golf when I would go back to Calgary early, for training camp, go back out a couple of weeks early. It was more just to train. And again, I wish I would have played more golf, but I didn't. That said, I resurrected kind of playing competitively in the off season when I got traded to Pittsburgh in 86. So by first time I was invited to Tahoe, I'd already played in a couple of Pennsylvania amateurs and or opens and, city stuff in and around Pittsburgh. But I Monday qualified for in the Ben Hogan Tour's inaugural year. They had a tournament in Pittsburgh and I was playing for Vancouver and I qualified for, I think that was in 90 or 91. I think it might've been 90. And they had the first, and then in that field was John Daly, Tom Lehman, Steve Stricker. It was won by RW Weeks. I remember it pretty vividly. But I Monday qualified and I played in a real Ben Hogan Tour event with those guys in the field as an active player. So, and come 91, I was pretty, I think I had a step up on all the guys in a sense that I knew how to play, but I also knew how to play tournament golf, and there's such a big difference. So I won it in 92, as you mentioned, and it was a pretty proud moment. It was one of the funnest things I'd ever done. Just being in that tournament was great, but I wanted to win it. In 91, my first year, I didn't have a good back nine on the Sunday, so I remember just saying I was going to come back and win it, and I did, and I shot under par, which sort of set the tone for everybody going, holy shit, these guys can play a little bit, so... exactly. I shot 3 under for the 3 days, which, as an active player, that's a spongy Poana greens. If anybody knows golf, it's not the easiest thing to do, even though I know the course, it's altitude and it's not set up long, but it's still getting, the putting and short game is what kills guys.
What's your best score, by the way, in competitive rounds, and what's your best score ever for 18 holes?
I shot 65 at Black Diamond, and that was my best competitive score. I've had 66s and 7s. I shot 14 under in Mary Lemieux's tournament, 66, 67, 69. Was, out of this world, and of course I lived on, and it was pretty fascinating. I shot 63, was the lowest score I ever shot in, remember, 2002, 9 birdies, 9 bogeys. And I'm not
where was that?
One of those guys.
Where
I mean,
was that?
These are Pine Tree Golf Club from the tips, from 7,000, which was a tipped out course. And it was a Saturday. I remember 9 birdies, 9 bogeys. It was fun. And the guys I was playing with were afraid to talk. And it was just funny. But actually, I shot, I think it might have been 65 as well. And I lost in a playoff to play in Doral in 1999 or 2000. Monday qualified it. I used to do all the Monday qualifiers around here for Honda. and whatnot. And they used to play them down at a place called Emerald Hills, where there's back then before the, and then the was whatever tour was Nike, I guess. All those guys wouldn't have any tournaments just yet. So we had, I think there was 280 guys. They had 180 or 200 guys at one spot for three spots. If you remember the old qualifier days, and I was at a spot with 80 guys for one spot, and three of us shot 65. And Adam Spring birdied the first one. I remember the guy's name even. So I think it was 99 or 2000. So yeah, I had some pretty high level golf at times.
Dan Quinn joining us on Musings on Sports. Dan and I live fairly close to one another here in South Florida. Hey Dan, wonder the hockey motion and the golf swing. Talk a little bit about that of how the one sort of carries over to the other. I know a lot of hockey players, yourself included, are in fact very good golfers. Does that translate from the rink to the golf course?
Well, I played hockey left-handed and golf right-handed. So, you know, it's an eye-hand coordination thing, I would think, more than anything. Or, you know, I'm pretty sure, you know, guys have sticks in their hand and that they apply themselves. But I know a lot of guys that are good golfers that are hockey players, but I know a lot of guys that aren't. So you have to have some grasp of how to swing or, you know, turn versus, it's just, there is similarities. If I was playing hockey left-handed and golf left-handed, I would have to try to figure that out, but I don't. I play golf. We were told there's no equipment and you need to play golf right-handed when I was a kid in the 70s, you know, learning how to play. So, so I don't, you know, I always say, I think, you know, hockey players are good athletes, obviously skating around pretty fast, and eye-hand coordination is pretty, you know, at the top of anything. So that's, you know, a premium in golf.
You mentioned about winning at Tahoe. What's that like? What's the pressure like as in an individual sport in winning the celebrity event compared to winning in the playoffs with teammates in a Stanley Cup run?
Well, Tahoe, you know, probably looking back, I made it too much of my life, but I couldn't wait to go back every year after we left, and we had celebrity golf tournaments for a while, and I was making pretty good money at it because it was, you know, they'd offered purses, and it was really competitive for about 10 or 12 or 15 of us that thought we could play or could play, and you know, winning at five, Rick Roden won at eight, and there's a few other guys that could play pretty good. Rick, you know, he plays well out on the senior tour, so I would say, you know, to win in our stuff, was you had to be pretty good. That said, you know, I won in 92 and was so excited, and then it was disappointed not to win. And then when I won at 01 and 02 and 04, you know, those years, and then they were kind of, everybody was getting sick of me winning, but those were the years that I was really pretty tough to beat. And I didn't go there thinking I wouldn't. And then I guess the other thing, my game and everything kind of did slide in the mid to 2000s, and I could still go out there and figure a way to compete. And I had a bunch of seconds and thirds and stuff, but to win it again 20 years after my first in 2012 was pretty cool as well.
You mentioned about playing Ben Hogan tours and playing in the with John Daly. You eventually caddied for John in the 2000 U.S. Open, and then caddied part time for a number of years when Ernie Els was on the regular tour. How did that happen? Come about caddying for John in the Open?
So the weekend I mentioned in Pittsburgh, and I think it was 2000, you know, I shot that, you know, 66, 67, 69, sitting in my backyard celebrating. Bud Martin, who is a great guy, great friend for 30 years, is John's agent. He's now Cam Smith and Leishman's agent, and, you know, collecting these big buckets of money at his house for his live money, these contracts he signed, I tease him about. But he calls me up on a Sunday. He goes, "Hey, DQ, it's Bud. John's out in California, but his caddy just twisted and broke his ankle. Would you have any interest in going out there?" And I go, "What?" I wasn't thinking of being a caddy at the time. So I ended up flying out, and I didn't know, you know, the whole role of what a caddy did and the information. And John had, you know, like 2-3 overs. He or Tiger won. So I learned a lot. I got to see a lot. You know, we played with Retief Goosen. I tell that story in the first two rounds. He shot 80-72 to make a cut on the number, and then he shot 272s on the weekend. And everybody goes, "What's that mean?" So I said he top 10. That got him back into the U.S. Open next year. He was a European Tour player with no tour status, and he won at Southern Hills in 2001 and set his career up just by making the cut in that year. You know, I shot him shoot 80. I said, "This guy can't play." But anyway, that was your Tiger one. I saw Tiger warming up at 4 a.m. when everybody else just took the easy way out. He did just full routine because there were some fog delays and finishing rounds in the mornings. It was, obviously that's when that year of 2000 was unbelievable. And the disappointment, well, for me, John made a 13 on 18 on Thursday and withdrew. So I got to go watch a lot of golf before I actually flew home on the Saturday. So it was, disappointing. As far as Ernie, I caddy for Jesper Parnevik as a friend and did it, you know, very professionally. Half dozen times he was, you know, asked me and was struggling, and in between caddies, I did the Florida swing for him once, and you know, took it very seriously and tried to learn and see what a lot of the guys do. And he goes, you're unbelievable. And, you know, I also was not afraid to say, hey, stop being a whiny, you know, because I wasn't looking to do, I was afraid to tell them to smarten up, you know. Mm-hmm. And he said, nobody would ever talk to me yet because I'd fire him. And, you know, but I'm not, well, I don't care. So, and he says, but it helped me. I wish they would do it. So then in many reinventions I did, I was working for the Ritz-Carlton, which is now Trump Jupiter near us, in 07 and 08. And then with the subprime crash, if you recall, my job got eliminated in early 09. And so Ernie, I think, was more than anything. Let me take you to Asia. We'll go make some money. And you know, so he took me over to Singapore in November. And we came 12th, I believe. And you know, I treated it extremely professionally, like it was, and he was blown away. You know, it wasn't like just a friend. It was like I was doing everything and more that a pro caddy would do, and reading putts for him. And a couple of funny stories about it. The first hole, I said to him, hey, do you want me to give you, like, you got 142 to the front and 176 to the hole. It's playing up 2 yards and it's, you know, down off the right. I said, do you want me to tell you what I think it's playing? He goes, Ben, look at my bag. My name is on there for a reason. Just give me the information, my friend. So I started laughing, but of course, by like the 15th green, you know, he's asking me what club, you know, 15th hole, he'd gotten confidence in me and reading putts and what club do you think this is? Fast forward, we go to China the next week. It's a World Golf Championship event that they've had over there for a number of years. If you remember, and Tiger, Phil, everybody plays in it. And we came second. He bogeyed the 18th hole, making to shoot 63 on Sunday to lose to Phil by one. And we had some beers and whatnot after, and he called me up about a week later. He goes, Dan, we're going to do this again. I got to figure something out. So in January, I opened the season with him. We went to Hawaii. And again, I think we had another top 10. So we had, you know, pretty good stretch just together in 3 weeks. We came home and did a split schedule with his current caddy, Ricky Roberts. And we did that. It got complicated at times, but yeah, we did that for the whole 2010. It was a great year for everybody. And then I back on, did some stuff, you know, like all stuff like that. Sometimes there's a little bit of a divorce and get back together. And then 11, I did a bunch more and through 2012. And then it got complicated again. You know, I win Tahoe the morning he wins the British Open in 2012. I win Tahoe that afternoon. Mm-hmm. And I'm supposed to go caddy for him. And I'm like, you got to take Ricky. I mean, the PGA's in 3 weeks, you know, so, you know, but I went and did Canada and Firestone. And then, you know, we sort of said, let's, you know, Ricky came back over and then Ricky got sick. So that's sort of how my rig is, you know, there was a lot of ins and outs, but the 2010 was a, you know, just a great schedule. Worked about 12, 14 events for him and won Tahoe. It was, and then, you know, could play my golf and do stuff as well. It was a lot of fun.
Dan Quinn, we're winding down with the former NHL hockey player and five-time winner of the American Century Celebrity Golf Classic. And what's Ernie like? Is the Big Easy the right term for him on the golf course? Does he ever get too high or too low?
Well, you know, I say this tongue in cheek. I call him the Big Uneasy. So he works very hard. He does, you know, so that's one thing everybody said, that he looks like he needs to work harder. He works very hard. He practices very hard. The week of a tournament, he, you know, he put in all the work and prep, and that I always respected. And he played very hard inside the ropes. He was always trying, but he's not as calm and cool as the exterior shows. He's very intense. He expects a lot of people around him. He expects the guys working for him, caddies, and the support staff, because he expects a lot out of himself. So, you know, it was fun. And that particular 09, 2010, because he was, you know, top 5, 6 in the world and winning. And then when that slowed down, you know, obviously it got to be, you know, it could be a little grumpier. But like I said, through ins and outs of a friendship and a relationship like that, you know, both sides and many mistakes on both of our parts. But he's still probably the funnest guy. If I said to somebody, you want to play golf with a tour pro and have a few beers after and have good conversations and stories, I don't think there's anybody better.
Oh, that's terrific. Dan Quinn, what are you up to these days?
I work for a group called the ID Fund. It's investor directed. So I just basically, I do marketing and business development for them. We offer, you know, late stage private companies to, you know, my network and investors, and they either invest or they don't. It's been interesting. And it's been through 3 years. I started just before COVID. So that was a interesting, you know, calling people in April and March and April and May of 2020 during COVID and asking them if they want to invest in something. And they're saying, my money's under my mattress, buddy. Just, you know, what are you, crazy? But somehow we made it. We had a decent year and met a lot of people and, you know, still trying to work. It's a 4-year-old company. So we're just still working through how to do the best we can. But we've got a tremendous year going right now. And it's been, I look forward to a lot more with them.
You still playing a lot of golf?
Not as much as I'd like to. You know, I kind of, when the COVID hit and I didn't play as much. And then now, you know, my son's you know, I'm going to brag. He just shot 69 yesterday at the regionals and down at Key Biscayne. So we were down there for Monday and he shot that yesterday. So we got states next week. So I've been trying to get a hold of a hotel up there, which I'm going to, but I couldn't get a signal to my house. So I'm going crazy this morning. But yeah, so I do, but it takes up a lot of my time. But this year is the first year he can drive. So I'm not on call, you know, to take him or pick him up at a golf course. So I want to get back into it playing, you know, a couple, three times a week.
Sounds like it's running in the genes in a good way with your son. Hey, Dan, thanks so much for joining us here in Musings on Sports. Really enjoyed it.
Titleist is the number one ball in golf. Yes, being number one is a number. And more players trust the Pro V1 or Pro V1X than all other golf balls combined. But being number one is more than a number. It's a mindset. It's a relentless mission to design and manufacture the best performing golf balls in the game. So you can chase whatever your number one is. Titleist, the number one ball in golf.
Really interesting to hear from Dan Quinn, Bob, and that he, you know, I thought when we first started talking to him that it was strictly going to be, you know, hockey first and then golf, but he played both as a kid growing up. And again, it goes to show, I'm a big fan of playing multiple sports growing up. I think you become such a more well-rounded person. Tremendous career in the NHL. And then, man, you can almost make the case he's had a better career playing golf.
Yeah, and that's a great point you make, Kelly, to all young athletes out there. At an earlier age, you're better off not focusing on, you know, just one sport. Avail yourself to a lot of sports, and then the sports that you're best at will shine even brighter. And, of course, Dan Quinn had a lot of enjoyment caddying for Ernie Els for quite a bit. And, boy, if you want to caddy for somebody, Ernie Els is about the nicest guy as you're ever going to find.
Yeah, and I thought he did a good, pretty good impersonation of Ernie. And yes, hopefully everybody enjoyed that. I want to thank Dan Quinn for being with us on Musings on Sports. As Bob and I noted, next week, Joe Lunardi, also known as Mr. Bracketology for ESPN, will be our guest. Lots to talk about how he got involved with bracketology for the NCAA men's basketball tournament and how big it has become. Bob, great being with you as always. Thank you all for listening to Musings on Sports.